This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, the 23rd of June, 2011. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood, coming up on the newscast. The Syrian regime continues its assault on towns and villages using soldiers and tanks.
In Jisr al-Shagour itself, they saw burnt-out buildings, they saw government buildings that had been burnt out.
Critics respond to the president's plan for Afghanistan, saying he's failing to make good on his campaign promises. And we meet a former Israeli Air Force captain who's aboard a US boat attempting to breach Israel's naval blockade of Gaza. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The Supreme Court today struck down a Vermont law that prohibited pharmacies from selling patient data to drug companies. Alice Olstein reports from Capitol Hill.
Many pharmacies collect and publish data on which drugs doctors are prescribing to their patients, and drug companies use the information to better market their products to doctors. Vermont passed a law to restrict the drug companies' data mining, but 6 of the 9 Supreme Court justices ruled that restriction unconstitutional. Justice Kennedy, who wrote the majority opinion, accused Vermont of regulating corporate speech. But Greg Beck, a lawyer with the group Public Citizen, disagrees.
I'm concerned that it suggests that the state has to treat drug companies sort of as a protected class, just like it would have to treat a racial minority as a special class.
Public Citizen says it's the patients, not the companies, that need the law's protection. Yet many media organizations, such as ProPublica, Hearst, Bloomberg, and the Associated Press, filed briefs in support of the drug companies. They say newspapers and corporations alike should have access to digital information. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
North Dakota is experiencing some of its worst floods ever, and water levels are expected to rise farther in the coming days. 10,000 residents of the city of Minot have evacuated their homes. Flooding is on track to be the worst in the city's recorded history. Flooding is affecting other parts of the country as well. Though less severe, rising waters in Nebraska have prompted states of emergency at 2 nuclear power plants. The Cooper Nuclear Station and Fort Calhoun Nuclear Power Plant are under U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission observation. The Fort Calhoun plant has been shut down since early June and won't restart until the flood danger has passed. As of Wednesday, parts of the grounds were under 2 feet of water, according to the NRC. An unusual event declaration has been made for both plants, the lowest on a 4-point scale of nuclear emergency notification. Republicans in New York State Senate are deciding today whether to allow legislation legalizing same-sex marriage to reach the Senate floor for debate. Many predict it will pass if the vote is allowed. This optimism stems, in part, from a high-profile Republican vote switch. Senator Jim Alesi announced he would support marriage equality. He spoke earlier this week at a rally in Albany.
I am the first Republican vote to be cast in the New York State Senate, and I'm proud to be a Republican. I will also be proud to be the first Republican voter to vote for marriage equality in this state.
Video posted by the Times Union. Republicans in the Senate are reportedly negotiating further shields for religious institutions that oppose same-sex marriage. More than 100 women were raped or attacked in the Democratic Republic of Congo between June 10th and 12th by paramilitary rebel groups. Doctors Without Borders told media that they had been treating victims of the attacks in South Kivu province. This region of the DRC has been witness to several of these mass rapes in the past few years. In other news, 4 policemen have been sentenced to death and the strangling death of a prominent DRC human rights activist last year. Floribert Chebeya was the head of the group Voice of the Voiceless. The murder prompted widespread international criticism. AFP reports that 3 of the 4 sentenced men are still on the run from authorities. 2 weeks after a cross-country caravan made public the stories of Mexico's drug war victims, many of its key participants held talks with the government today. From Mexico, FSRN's Shannon Young reports.
People who have lost loved ones in the ongoing drug war sat down with the Mexican president and key cabinet members in what was billed as a dialogue. It was the first time a large group of victims told their stories directly to the Mexican officials driving and carrying out domestic drug war policy. The format of the dialogue resembled that of a city council meeting, with most victims facing time limits on their public comments and officials giving lengthy responses.
Me gustaría, por supuesto, ser recordado.
President Felipe Calderón says he would like to be remembered for promoting education, public health, and infrastructure development, but recognizes the drug war will probably be his administration's most lasting legacy. He defended his policy as a tough decision that had to be made. Poet Javier Cecilia told the president it was a mistake to fight cartels with institutions that are themselves rotten from the inside out. While the talks don't appear likely to bring about any major policy shift, the president agreed to give them continuity and meet with movement leaders again in 3 months. Shannon Young, FSRN.
And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Danny Wood in San Francisco. In Syria, the regime of President Bashar al-Assad is continuing its assault on towns and villages in the northwest of the country. Today, very close to the Turkish border, troops backed by tanks entered the village of Kirbet al-Juz. Hundreds of refugees are continuing to flee to Turkey, where more than 10,000 are now in makeshift refugee camps near the border. Towns and villages in this northwestern region are now deserted after the Syrian authorities launched a military operation in response, they said, to attacks on their security forces by gunmen in the town of Jisr al-Shagur. Local witnesses say the gunmen were security forces shot by the army for refusing to fire on unarmed civilians. United Nations agencies, international diplomats, and members of the Syrian media were allowed access to the area earlier this week under the supervision of the Syrian authorities. The UN Refugee Agency spokesperson in Geneva, Sibella Wilkes, described to UN Radio what the mission found.
From about 40 kilometres before Jisr al-Shagur, my colleague was telling me that they really saw very, very few people working in the field. Really, the villages like ghost towns, and Jisr al-Shagur, again, with very, very few people there. In Jisr al-Shagur itself, they saw burnt-out buildings, they saw government buildings that had been burnt out.
Wilkes said they were shown an alleged mass gravesite, but they were unable to verify the bodies or who killed them. During this supervised visit, UN personnel were unable to get access to any displaced people on the Syrian side of the border, but Wilkes said refugees in the Turkish camps have reported abductions, torture, and murder by the Syrian security forces. Meanwhile, protests in Syria against the regime and calls for international intervention continue. An amateur video uploaded to YouTube shows a group of young Syrian women holding and then setting light to a sign which reads in English, "Made in China, Russia and Iran." Those countries are against a Libya-style international intervention in Syria. Britain and France have been calling for a UN resolution condemning the violence used by the Syrian regime. Since the uprising began, the UN says about 1,200 people have been killed and many thousands more detained. President Barack Obama's plan, announced in last night's address to the nation, to bring 10,000 troops home from Afghanistan this year and another 23,000 next year, is receiving an angry response from progressives. Matt Laszlo reports that, coupled with his stance on Libya, the president's recent foreign policy decisions are causing unrest in Washington.
In announcing the withdrawal of his force of 33,000 surge troops, President Obama told the nation he wants to divert those resources back home.
Over the last decade, we have spent $1 trillion on war at a time of rising debt and hard economic times. Now we must invest in America's greatest resource, our people.
Under President Obama's new plan, by September 2012, there will be the same amount of U.S. troops in Afghanistan as when he became president. Congressperson John Garamendi of California says maintaining 70,000 troops there will be costly.
There appears to be little diminution in the cost of this adventure to the American treasury.
Democratic Congressperson Lynn Woolsey says she was let down by the president's address.
The hope was that the president would offer an Afghanistan troop drawdown that was significant, swift, and sizable. His proposal failed on all three counts.
The announcement means the U.S. could be at war in Afghanistan for more than 3 years. Administration officials say there are less than 100 members of al-Qaeda still in the country, which begs the question, what's the goal of the mission? Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies says the president failed to redirect the mission. She says pulling out these troops isn't enough.
That's not a strategy. There is no strategy because everyone agrees there is no military victory possible.
Polls show the majority of Americans want the U.S. out of Afghanistan. But while many freshman Republicans are expressing more support for a conclusion to the war, analysts say the president will still find congressional support mostly from the GOP conference. Oklahoma Republican Congressperson Tom Cole says he's been impressed with the president's strategy thus far.
I think he's actually been hawkish on Afghanistan, and he's been very consistent in that. He's made that point during the campaign that he thought this was critical, a central front on terrorism. He made the point about how important it was for us to be deeply involved in Pakistan. He's actually been very consistent in this area.
But Libya is a whole different question altogether. While praising Obama for being hawkish in Afghanistan, Cole says he thinks the president has overstepped the law in Libya.
For somebody that served in the United States Senate to disregard the Congress to the extent that he has, I think is just unconscionable. And I think he could have had the support that he wanted if he'd have just come 90 days ago and laid out a mission, a rationale, that he probably could have put together a bipartisan support. Having not done this, this has gone from bad to worse in terms of congressional opinion.
In the Senate, the president seems to have more support for the Libya war. Arizona Senator John McCain is co-sponsoring a measure to authorize the conflict with Massachusetts Democratic Senator John Kerry. And even McCain says he strongly disagrees with the president's claim that U.S. forces are not engaged in hostilities.
When you're sending out predators and killing people and you're doing other things, that is conflict.
As early as this Friday, the House could vote on two separate Libya bills. One that would authorize the war is expected to be defeated. Another measure that blocks funding of the operation is expected to pass. Ohio Democratic Congressperson Dennis Kucinich is lobbying for support for the second resolution.
But I think that we need to give better advice to the president that this mission is not possible, that it's misguided.
Some question whether the president will listen to that advice. And Kucinich says if Obama doesn't, he risks having progressive voters sit out of the 2012 election. Matt Laszlo, FSRN, Washington.
Tensions remain high in Sudan's southern Kordofan state after tens of thousands of civilians fled fighting between northern and southern troops. Some are concerned about the fate of refugees in Kadugli after Sudanese intelligence agents disguised as Red Crescent workers threatened them if they didn't amass at a stadium. That information was from an internal report obtained by the Associated Press. There was no information on what happened to the refugees, but some observers say the Nuba people are again facing targeted attacks. Additionally, the UN is demanding the release of six of its national staff arrested yesterday.
The humanitarian agencies in South Kordofan are still unable to access the civilian population and those in need, despite a kind of stabilization for the last 2-3 days. Situation is improving. There are air movement, but no shelling as the time we speak. But there are still an estimated 73,000 people displaced since the 5th of June when the fighting broke out. And some people who have taken refuge in the peacekeepers' compound now apparently return to the town of Kadugli. But they still need assistance, at least within the UN compound. They were getting this assistance, food and potable water. And we are still concerned by what happened to those who fled toward the mountains, the Nuba Mountains, and who are hiding in caves or in the bush. We don't know how many are there, and we need to have access to those people.
The issue of access has been pending for quite a long time. Why is it that you've not been granted access?
The situation is still volatile, and we are discussing with the authorities to get full access to Kadugli town and full access to the other IDPs. It's a situation which is not completely clear. There are movement restrictions, some violence erupts from time, sporadic gunfires, and because of this insecurity, this limits our ability to assess the situation and to provide the people the aid they urgently need. What we ask is full and unimpeded access to the civilian, to the population. The threats to aid workers and peacekeepers need to stop immediately. And we need also to get full air access to the airport in order to provide assistance and fly assistance into this place as soon as possible.
That was Elizabeth Beers with the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs speaking to UN Radio's Patrick Maigwa. In the coming days, a flotilla of about 10 boats carrying hundreds of passengers will attempt to get through Israel's coastal blockade of the Gaza Strip. The aim is to non-violently challenge the blockade and support Palestinian human rights. This week, Israeli authorities announced their intention to enforce their naval blockade, and yesterday, the US State Department issued a new travel warning strongly urging Americans not to travel to the Gaza Strip, noting that previous attempts to access Gaza by sea resulted in the injury, death, arrest, and deportation of US citizens. Since the so-called Freedom Flotillas started a few years ago, some have managed to successfully reach Gaza's port, but others have been intercepted and turned back, often violently, by the Israeli authorities. In May last year, half a dozen vessels with hundreds of passengers supported by a Turkish humanitarian organization were attacked by Israeli commandos, killing 9 on board, including 1 US citizen. One of the boats in this latest flotilla is a US-flagged ship, the Audacity of Hope, with about 50 American passengers, crew, and members of the press. In an open letter to President Obama, they explain that their peaceful demonstration aboard the boat named after his best-selling book is about non-violently challenging US foreign policy and Israel's blockade of Gaza, which they say has effectively imprisoned 1.6 million civilians. One of the crew members on the Audacity of Hope is Yonatan Shapira, a former captain in the Israeli Air Force. He joins us now from Athens, Greece, where the boats are preparing. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Hi, thank you for calling me.
I understand some of the boats are not actually carrying any aid. Why is that?
Some of the boats actually are carrying aid. Some of the flotilla boats are cargo ships with cement and other things, but this is not the main thing behind the flotilla. The main idea is not to provide the humanitarian aid, but to create pressure on the guards of the ghetto. And I'm using this the hard words because Gaza now is ghetto, is an open-air prison where people cannot go freely in and out. Gaza needs help and support, but they need international pressure to make sure that the walls of the ghetto will fall.
As a crew member on the boat, what are your duties exactly, and how are you preparing for the prospect of a possible intervention by the Israeli authorities?
My duty as a crew member, we are four, and we will take turn and sailing this boat and make sure that everything is safe. When you talk about what are we preparing for at the time of interception by the Israeli army, we are non-violent and we are not going to obey the orders of the military. We don't recognize their authority in international water and in Gaza water, but we are not going to use any kind of violence.
You were a captain in the Israeli Air Force for 8 years. Why did you become an activist for Palestinian rights, and is there any one event that was important in your transformation?
You know, I was a captain in the Air Force and flew Black Hawk helicopters and, you know, felt for a long time that I'm really part of what I believe the Israeli Defense Forces. But slowly, I realized that it's not defending, and it's actually occupation forces and the violence that is being used by the army that I used to be part of is actually what put the people that I'm supposed to defend in great danger. So from the same interest of defending my people, but this time to defending all the people, I decided that it's better to refuse these orders, even if I personally did not have to shoot anyone or fly attack helicopters. I still was part of a system that was part of a big crime. So in 2003, I, with the help of other pilots, we organized a group of Israeli Air Force pilots who refused publicly to continue to be part of the occupation. And since 2003, I can say that I'm quite active with different human rights projects. And I hope other people will join me and my friends as soon as possible.
Last September, you were on board a boat in a voyage like this one to Gaza, but that time with Europeans of Jewish ancestry, including a very elderly Holocaust survivor. You were all detained by the Israeli authorities. Can you tell us what happened?
We were just 9 people on the boat. One of the members was Reuven Moshkovitz, who is 82 years old, was a Holocaust survivor from Romania, who now lives in Jerusalem. We were just 9 people, but the symbolism is that Jews from around the world are joining forces to make a statement that we are totally against the crimes of the Israeli government, and they don't do it in our name, they don't speak in our name. We were all arrested pretty violently. Although none of us was violent toward the soldiers, and we basically sat and held hands and hugged each other and sang "We Shall Overcome" and some Hebrew songs of love and peace. The soldiers were quite brutal. At least in my case, they shot me with a taser gun in my heart. I don't recommend it.
Yonatan Shapira, crew member aboard the Audacity of Hope. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
In New York City, activists have been camping out for over a week near City Hall in protest of proposed layoffs and cuts to public services. They vow to remain until their demands are met. Community News Production Institute reporter Jessel Knorr brings us more.
Since June 14th, dozens of activists, students, teachers, and union members under the umbrella group New Yorkers Against Budget Cuts have been sleeping on the sidewalk near City Hall. They call it Bloombergville, after the city's billionaire mayor, Michael Bloomberg. The 24-hour-a-day demonstration is an escalation to the almost weekly protests that started in February. Demonstrators oppose the mayor's budget cuts, which would lay off thousands of public sector employees, close fire stations, and cut funding for vital programs, including summer youth jobs, senior centers, and healthcare services. Protesters are demanding the budget deficit be closed by increasing taxes on the wealthy. This is Queens resident Raymond Burke Jr.
The budget cuts are going to affect everybody. When they shut down a firehouse and then your house catches fire or your business catches fire and the fire department is too late to respond, then you're going to understand. When they shut down your kid's school, then you're going to understand.
Topping the list of the protesters' concerns is the proposed teacher layoffs and the $350 million cut from the education budget. Sam Coleman is a New York public school teacher.
I teach in a low-income neighborhood, mostly immigrants, and my school is going to lose funding that's going to eliminate after-school programs, going to eliminate art programs, going to eliminate materials that we badly need, as well as teachers getting excessed or laid off.
Activists say they draw inspiration from the rolling rebellions in the Arab world, Greece, and the recently dismantled Walkerville in Madison, Wisconsin. Organizer Emily Taronis recently returned from studying in Spain, where residents also erected a tent city to protest austerity measures.
I personally had been at the Puerta del Sol in Madrid in their tent city experience, and as soon as I got back to the States, I was involved in planning for Bloombergville, which was very serendipitous. It's obviously been a very different experience than what's going on in Madrid. Namely, the police force has been very different here. We often have more police officers than protesters.
Heavy rains and police pressure has forced the camp to relocate 6 times. There's also been one arrest. Last Thursday, a 17-year-old high school graduate was arrested and charged with obstructing pedestrian traffic. He asked not to be named.
It was just part of a
planned by the cops to intimidate us, to demoralize us by taking, you know, one of the youngest people there and arresting them. But in fact, that didn't work. You know, from what I understand, and when I got back, I got a huge round of applause. And when I was gone, everyone was saying that everyone was energized, everyone was trying to get me free, everyone was excited to have me come back as soon as possible and you know, continue the struggle.
Despite the challenges, the camp continues to attract new participants every day. Hundreds have taken part, mostly in rotating shifts. The number of overnight campers has fallen from more than 100 that slept out the first night to about 36. New Yorker Gary Rowland says the public's gratitude has made living outside worth it.
The best part about this whole thing is the response we get from people walking back. 9 times out of 10, they're very supportive of what we're doing, and they're glad that somebody's finally standing up for the interests of the common people rather than just the billionaires.
The camp sits on the bustling downtown Manhattan intersection of Broadway and Park Place. The majority of passersby appear indifferent, but many do stop to express their support, including New Yorkers Hillary Moore, John Randall, and Rhonda Vargas.
I think it's hard to stand up in the city. It's such an arterial place, and people walk by you and don't pay attention.
Like it says here, Bloomberg's cuts are going to affect 6,100 teachers. $50 million in cuts just for childcare. I mean, I think education is one of the most important things.
Uplifting to know that they are, to know that they're out there fighting for all of us. It's like a few are fighting for so many, and it's wonderful.
City council members and union leadership are currently deadlocked with the mayor in negotiations over the budget, ahead of a June 30th deadline. Bloombergville's participants hope their actions push their representatives to take a strong stand against the cuts, in the same way that Wisconsin's student and rank-and-file teacher protests compelled much of that state's political and union leadership to take part in a massive uprising against Governor Scott Walker's anti-union bill earlier this year. Bloombergville organizer Yotan Marin says the support of New York's powerful unions has been limited to symbolic gestures, such as providing food to hungry campers.
They're in a different position than us. They want to be at the negotiating table, and we don't expect to be at the negotiating table, and we're like the part of the movement that's going to push harder and more radically and intensify the struggle. I wish that they were here with us, because I think that would make the critical mass. I think if they were all here with us, then it would make it unnecessary to have to cut deals.
The camp's main political supporter has been Democratic Council Member Charles Barron of East New York. Echoing protesters, Barron says cuts to public services can be averted by raising taxes on wealthy New Yorkers.
We can balance this budget overnight. The bottom line, in every state of the union where there's been a deficit, the tax breaks to the rich, the subsidies to the rich corporations are greater than the deficit. So if they want to cut something, cut tax breaks, cut subsidies, not services and layoffs.
Most of those camped out readily admit they alone cannot block the harsh austerity measures. But 17-year-old New Yorker Lucas Vasquez says he hopes Bloombergville will be a catalyst for a movement that can influence change.
I mean, this is a long-term movement, and all long-term movements have to start somewhere, and this pretty radical action in the typical left actions of New York City. I mean, we're actually occupying and sleeping in. That doesn't really happen in New York City, and hopefully it'll grow.
Activists say they will remain at Bloombergville through the budget vote. Jessel Noor, FSRN, New York.
And that's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Headlines editor, Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Matt Laszlo. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Scott Pham. FSRN welcomes your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood.